Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello. I am here again. It's Wednesday here in the U.S., and it's 4 o'clock here in the U.S., and I'm just really glad to be talking to all of you and to get the chance to interview really, really wonderful people. And today is just no exception at all. In fact, it's an extraordinary man. And I'm just gonna ask, Peter, are you there?
I'm here. Yes, I hope you can hear me okay.
Excellently. Well, good. I'll come back to you in a second. Folks, things are going extremely well here in what I'm attempting to do. And but we've got bigger plans for organizing on a larger level. But for now, please, if you haven't signed up for my frequent alerts, they're free on the website, please go to them. You're a great audience. You keep me alive knowing you're there to communicate with. And if you don't get my frequent alerts, please do. Just Breggin.com, www.breggin.com. This week, I've put up on the frequent alert an essay written for a journal that my friend Michael Cornwall, the amazing American psychologist, himself a survivor of an extraordinary breakdown, and then, of course, of the mental health system, who went on to become, that is, a moving figure. He wrote something so beautiful about helping and getting help. So beautiful that I literally don't have words for it. And I want you to go and take a look at that. And then we have our fourth honored blogger award. The award went to Bonnie Burstein. And Bonnie, as a part of that award, wrote a blog about teaching, how she teaches fundamentally anti-psychiatry at the University of Toronto. I mean, it's really quite amazing. And before that, there's a blog that will surprise my guest about the NRA coming out in the U.S. and saying, look, let's look at the school shootings. It's not just guns. And of course, they have a vested interest in it's not just guns. But Ollie North, the head of the NRA, National Rifle Association, coming out and saying, we got to look at the medications. And in the school shootings. I think that's a really, really, really important thing that it even gets brought up on that national level. And I think it's the biggest level it's really been brought up on. But also here in the U.S., good news, some other folks, at this point, interestingly enough, conservative people, interestingly enough, maybe it's because of the gun issue, they want to talk about medications, but they are talking about medications and school shootings. Complex politics here in the U.S. So please stay in touch with me. And the website is just continuing to prosper. A day or so ago, my last data, we had over 3,000 unique visitors to the website in a day. That's a lot for a professional website, let me tell you. And 16,000 actual visits in the day. So those are big numbers. They're good numbers. And we're going to be finding ways to expand it as much as possible. But come visit the website. New stuff goes up all the time. And the frequent alert is the best way to just stay in touch without visiting. Now, my guest, Peter Kinderman, he's just an amazing, wonderful psychologist. He's the kind of psychologist that we'd be hard put to even have in the U.S. because he speaks truth to power. And that gets you in such bad trouble here. And today, I think Well, let me tell you a little bit more about Peter. He's a professor of psychology. He's been, even when during the days when he's been on our show, my show here, he's been president of the British Psychological Society, but has moved on from that. He's published, over 100 scientific papers. He's interested in a wide range of issues. He actually gets grant money, lots of grant money, even though he takes very honest and strong stands. And his most recent book is A Prescription for Psychiatry. I invite him to begin by talking about that, A Prescription of Psychiatry. And in our chat today on email, because I had so much trouble figuring out my phone, international phone call today, our email exchange, we've kind of decided that he's going to take us on a bit of a tour today of what's going on in Great Britain, because Great Britain has many more professionals willing to stand up on issues. They have more effect, I do believe, as practitioners often on what goes on than we do here in the U.S. So it's a very interesting situation over there. And so I invite Peter Kenderman on to talk about his book, A Prescription for Psychiatry, and also the overall scene, what's going on in Great Britain. Peter, hi. It's good to have you on again.
Thank you. So, well, yes, I mean, it's a really interesting day to be speaking to because of actually some of the actions that I've been involved with just today, this Wednesday. But going back just a few years, so, yeah, I mean, there are lots of psychologists, psychiatrists, commentators in the UK who've got quite a critical, skeptical, psychosocial perspective on mental health. And there's always been that strand within UK psychiatry and UK clinical psychology that's been a little bit critical and creative, I think. So just as context, one of the things that is quite valuable in the UK is that we have a group called the Critical Psychiatry Network. So this is a group of psychiatrists who are interested in putting forward more of a social psychiatry or critical psychiatry perspective rather than a biomedical perspective on mental health. And the fact that that group exists, not critical of psychiatry, but critical within psychiatry, has always been very valuable for us. For me, I published my book, Prescription for Psychiatry, nearly 4 years ago now. And I knew I was being deliberately provocative when I chose a title like A Prescription for Psychiatry. And I have to say that some members of that profession took a little bit of objection to the idea of psychologists supposedly telling them how
to do
their
job.
I was
going to say that. You can't even write prescriptions. How can you prescribe for us?
Exactly. Yes. And, oh, just the usual stuff of if you disapprove of people writing prescriptions, why did you write one? And all of that sort of stuff. What's interesting, and I took quite a critical line, I think, suggesting that mental health problems were primarily distressing but common sense expressions of the distress that we all experience from time to time. People get depressed, people get anxious, sometimes people harm themselves, sometimes people hear voices, sometimes people develop beliefs which are very difficult to understand and very distressing for them. But that's kind of what human beings do. These are not emanations of diseased brains so much as examples of how human beings think, especially when subjected to enormous interpersonal stress. So that was basically the perspective of the book. And then I took some conclusions from that about how we collectively should go about offering people places of safety that aren't hospitals, how we should fund therapeutic and helpful interventions rather than prescribing medical treatments for their brains, and also how we should use chemicals, how we should use medication sensibly, I think. I don't think that necessarily means never using any sort of psychoactive chemical. I myself this morning, didn't get much sleep, so I was tired, so I was very happy to drink coffee, which stimulated me and probably made me perform a little bit better in the morning than I otherwise would have done. But I didn't think it was putting right a chemical abnormality in my brain that was leading to a disease process. So I think the pragmatic and sensible use of medication, the cautious use of medication, the skeptical use of medication, but more importantly, developing a psychosocial perspective on mental health. And I mean, that's what I outline in Prescription for Psychiatry.
Peter, let me, in my practice, I actually have now, and I'm wondering if there's anybody in Great Britain like me. I mean, Terry Lynch in Ireland, I know, is.
Yes.
That who just doesn't use the meds. I mean, maybe twice a year, I might give somebody who's starting a manic episode 1 or 2 days of Valium at night, and it holds over for the day and it helps them get through this potentially terribly destructive thing called a manic episode. But I don't use the meds. I'm in the Critical Psychiatry Network, but I want to, just for our folks to know, are we talking about people who take my position, or is it more this very strong, but a little bit more cautious position?
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that the majority of practicing psychiatrists in the UK are probably quite liberal and conventional with their use of medication.
I mean, among the critics Joanna Moncrief, yourself.
Exactly.
Is anybody taking my position, which is we're really better off without these drugs?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there are clearly a large number of psychiatrists who would be very strongly of your opinion that we're better off avoiding the drugs if at all possible. I think that there's a whole spectrum of opinion. So, I mean, there are some psychiatrists who, because of the nature of their practice, have decided not to use medication as part of their practice and therefore almost exclusively work as psychotherapists. For a lot of psychiatrists working in the mainstream, I think they would very much take, those who are members of the Critical Psychiatry Network would very much take your perspective that medication should be used when people are in crisis. And one of the things that I and a few of my
colleagues position. I'm literally saying twice a year, maybe twice a year.
Okay. Well,
I might give somebody Valium. Otherwise, I'm just taking people off. I mean, I don't leave open that they're good for crit. I'm leaving open that maybe, to just because they can't get it on the drugstore by themselves here, they might be able to get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think
a sleeping pill for one night so you can avoid a breakdown.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole range of professional practice. I mean, I have to say that quite a lot of the people who take your perspective will have chosen, in the UK, will have chosen not to work in areas where medication is a particular issue, so they will practice as psychotherapists. For people working in the mainstream, I suspect they would use medication a little bit more liberally than you do, but certainly there are a large number of psychiatrists who would see medication as a pragmatic crisis response. Joanna Moncrief, for instance, Sami Tamimi, and people
like
that.
For example, Joanna, It's so different than here in the U.S., even though there may not be too many people, just doing psychotherapy or taking people off drugs like I do. It's such a different world, folks. And I think it's important. I want to celebrate it today. I want to celebrate that Great Britain is moving more in a good direction than the U.S. because it can give us some hope.
Well, that's
here,
what I wanted
we have this following. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, one of the things about the UK, I think, is that I mean, like many countries, there's a degree of sort of professional momentum. So most psychiatrists operate in relatively similar ways. There's obviously differences in practice. What I see in the UK is a bit of a sea change in the attitude of politicians and regulators and policymakers. So the meeting that I was at today was in the UK Parliament. It was a relatively informal meeting. So it wasn't a meeting of government ministers. It was a meeting of members of Parliament who are interested in the area. But we were talking about a coordinated plan of action by government agencies to look at the way in which we regulate the way in which medication is used in psychiatry. So we were talking about conducting well-funded and well-run and quite comprehensive analysis of the available evidence on prescription rates, on the way in which medication is used, on the patterns of medication use, on the information that's given to patients about the medication, and trying to plot some of these vexed issues about adverse effects of medication, and especially about the experiences that people have when trying to discontinue taking medication. And there's two bits of work that are already underway, one by an agency called Public Health England, which is the state-run agency that guards public health. And they've been tasked by government, by the Ministry of Health, to undertake a review of the evidence for dependence on prescription drugs. The other thing is work done by our National Institute of Health and Care Excellence, NICE, which is looking at beginning the process of drawing up guidelines for clinicians on how to help people withdraw from medication. And this is quite important, because instead of it being an ad hoc process by individual psychiatrists helping their clients come off medication, or possibly people using websites or sharing best practice, if we can start to develop evidence-based methodologies for helping people come off medication, you can see how it starts to change the approach. But the most important thing is that this is something supported by our parliamentarians. Admittedly, not all of them, and an interest group within Parliament. But you can see how quite senior opinion formers in the UK establishment are starting to take very seriously the idea that we as a society need to get a grip on the way in which we prescribe and the way in which we rely on medication, and that possibly some controls on the way in which we've used medication up until now need to be put in place in order to protect people. One of the differences, I think, between the UK and the US is at the moment in the UK we're focusing on antidepressant use for various reasons that I can go into about why that's a current issue in the UK. In the US there's a particular crisis, I think, around opioids. So you can see differences between the UK and the US in terms of where we're placing our focus. But I think the idea that our national parliament, our legislators, and some of the state-controlled agencies and regulatory bodies are starting to look very seriously at the idea of the adverse consequences of very liberal prescription, about the difficulties that people have in withdrawing, and starting to put in place some guidelines for helping to reverse that process. That's extremely positive news from my perspective.
Oh, I think it's wonderful news. I'm tempted to kind of go off and try to think about differences between the two countries, but I just want to hear you talk more, because it's very important, folks. We live in a big world, and the Great Britain is making some movement. So is Denmark under the leadership of Peter Goetze. So we have, and other things. Have you been in close touch with Peter Goetze?
Yes. So Peter is a member of a group that I'm a member of, which is the Council for Evidence-Based Psychiatry. So this is just another little group of like-minded individuals who come together to share information. So Peter is part of that small group with myself, with Sammy Tamimi, James Davis, Luke Montague, Anne Guy, Joanna Moncrief. So Peter has been very closely associated with this work. I mean, I think the international comparisons are fascinating. So Denmark has made some quite valuable progress in the idea of not controlling, that's too strong a word, but at least regulating the use of psychiatric medication to children. And there are some positive moves in the UK as well in terms of restricting the over-liberal prescription of Ritalin, for instance. So Denmark is possibly leading on that. The UK is, the US, as I said, has got a particular issue with opioid prescriptions, and these do seem to be prescriptions made by healthcare professionals, which is a particular issue. The UK, we've had a particular focus on antidepressants. It's also worth mentioning in Norway a rather interesting law that was passed in Norway that has required each hospital, each healthcare provider, to allocate amongst its beds in residential units provision for people who require inpatient or residential care but don't want to take medication. And that, the reason why that's important is it's almost routine for people admitted to crisis care in psychiatric units, especially with psychotic experiences, that almost as a necessary consequence of being admitted to hospital, they take antipsychotic medication. What Norway has done is that it hasn't legislated to regulate which individual patients should or shouldn't take medication. But what they've said is that a proportion of the beds available in any one hospital need to be set aside for people who need residential care but don't wish to take medication. And you can see why that would have an impact on the way that the services are structured, and also I think the way in which services are thought about, because for me, from my perspective, it's important to disentangle the idea of somebody in a psychological crisis and needing care from somebody who's got a brain disease who needs to take medication. And so decoupling that in Norway, I think, is very valuable. The Danish focus on the safeguarding of children, especially the use of stimulants for children, is very important. And like I say, in the UK, we've got a particular focus at the moment on antidepressants. But more widely, we're looking at the issue of dependence-forming drugs is one of the forms of words that the medics are using. So drugs which are prescribed by doctors but themselves have the capacity to form dependence. And the fact that we're taking that quite seriously at quite a senior level, I think, it's very positive. I mean, personally, I think that the way forward is to learn from what we're doing in the UK and for other countries to emulate that, for us to look at what's happening in the US and where there's good practice to copy that, to look at what Peter and others are doing in Denmark, safeguard children that way, and possibly to see whether we can put pressure on our healthcare providers to implement policies such as those in Norway, where people have residential care but they're not expected to take medication. And so we can take the best from each nationality, put it together, and we get something approaching a better mosaic of healthcare. But certainly in the UK, right at the moment, there are some glimmers of hope. It has to be said that it looks as if our rates of prescription of psychiatric medication are still going up. So we're starting to take action in order to address what is still a rising trend. So I don't think we have success yet, but what we've got is the beginnings of action, I think.
I think all this is really terrific news. Anything more about this difference between what's going on now around Europe? And some of this is new information for me. Anything else going around Europe and Great Britain that would be of interest to us or that has been going on over the years?
Well, I think two things to add, I suppose, two related points. I think the first is the importance of data, so to get information. So we have been very successful in the UK just recently of persuading policymakers, regulatory bodies, to begin the process of inquiring into the need for some better controls of the use of medication. But what then happens is that, quite rightly, at least in my opinion, I'm still a professor of clinical psychology, so I'm still a scientist at the end of the day, what those regulatory bodies ask for is evidence. And it's, I think it's right to suggest that anecdotes, stories from people about the harm done to them by psychiatric medication isn't quite good enough. We need systematic data on the harms and the benefits and the consequences of attempting to discontinue medication. So one of the things that's important is, as we start to win the argument where regulators take these issues seriously, there's a responsibility on those of us who've been arguing in that direction to make sure that data is available to back up the worries that we have. So the other thing that I think we need to look at is the way in which we get increasing publication of collection of reliable information about people's use of medication, both good and ill. And you can see that there's starting to be better information about that. So just as an example, in the UK, one of the issues that's been particularly contentious recently has been some statements, quite bold statements made about the nature, severity and duration of any discontinuation or withdrawal experiences from antidepressant medication. And it's been very difficult to find reliable information about that, but we're starting to collect more and more robust data on how many people experience withdrawal effects and how many people and how severe and for how long a duration those experiences are. And that also is valuable because when people complain about medication and express our worries about medication, a reasonable response from the authorities is to say, you know, show us the hard information. So we have to be prepared to conduct that research in order to provide the data.
And you're more able to do that because you have more organized central health care. That's, I guess, it is one of the advantages of centralized health care.
So that was one of the things discussed at the meeting I was at today, in fact, of our one of our organisations, Public Health England. It's the equivalent of the Centres for Disease Control in Atlanta. It serves the same function in our healthcare system. And they've started the process of looking at quite literally every single prescription for several, basically the major classes of psychiatric medication issued in the United Kingdom since 2015, and starting to process the data that results from that survey. I mean, it's, you know, we've got 65 million people in the UK, and 4 years of prescription is going to be at the individual patient level, I should say, and processing that information in order to get a picture of what's happening in terms of prescription of psychiatric medication will take some time. But at the end of that process, which should take a few months, we should have a much better picture than before about how and in what way and what consequences there are for people of taking medications. So I think we're starting the process. There's also, you know, surveys of patient experience that we're also looking at the information that is given to people when they take medication, what they're told by their psychiatrist or family doctor or healthcare provider about the medication. And yeah, like I say, we're starting the process of becoming much more systematic in collecting data. And I have to say, from my perspective, the data that we are seeing is a little bit worrying, with relatively larger number of people describing adverse effects of psychiatric medication, relatively large numbers of people reporting quite noticeable adverse effects when trying to discontinue, and some of those problems being quite serious and quite long lasting. So we're starting to get a picture which is a little bit more worrying than some of the bland reassurances given to people when they often start taking the medication in the first place. You know, the idea that the drugs aren't addictive, that they could stop at any time without any major consequences, and that any discontinuation experiences are likely to be quite mild and only last a few days. The evidence we're getting is that that's simply not true, that a relatively larger number of people have quite serious discontinuation experiences.
Yeah. See, in this country, all prescribers, all groups of prescribers, there are always exceptions, of course, but all groups of prescribers pretty much tell people that, oh, you just have to stay on the drug for a little while longer. And no, you don't need to come off this drug. You really need to stay on it for the rest of your life or for a long time or whatever. It's just very casually done that you'll get over the adverse effects, everything will be fine.
Well, again, what we're seeing is a number of things. So we're looking at the moment, and in fact, one of the jobs of work that I've got to do is to collate some opinions on this about the guidance that is given to physicians about what they should tell people about psychiatric medication, especially antidepressant medication. And yes, people are actually advised that the correct thing to say to people is, as you say, that the consequences of stopping taking medication is usually quite mild. And we think that might need some revision. The other thing that happens is routinely people are told that the medication is not addictive. And we have some concerns about that, because the definition of being addictive is in that context is quite technical and limited. And certainly in my opinion, if you tell somebody that a drug is not addictive, you're kind of telling them that they could stop taking it at any time without any negative consequences. A drug of addiction is one which, once you start taking it, you're hooked, right? And so therefore, being told that a drug is not addictive is kind of telling people that, don't worry about it, it's perfectly safe to take it because you can stop at any time. And of course, if in the most technical sense of the word, the medication is not addictive, but if you stop taking it, there are various negative consequences. So the original problems that you had might return, or you might actually get a physical consequence of the drug discontinuation itself. You know, if the drugs are blocking the reuptake of serotonin and then you stop taking them, it's going to have an effect on your brain chemistry, right? So for people to be told the drugs are not addictive, we think that needs to be unpacked a little bit. We also don't know at the moment what people are actually told in practice. So one of the things that is an issue for discussion in the UK at the moment is the idea of psychiatric medication correcting abnormal imbalances in brain chemistry. So we've got a curious position whereby the Royal College of Psychiatrists suggests that biochemical imbalances is not an appropriate explanatory model for the origin of mental health problems. And yet we get anecdotal evidence, at least, that's very frequently the explanation given to people as to why they might want to take the medication that they're offered. So there's a lot to unpack in terms of what people are told the drugs do, what they're told about the rationale for taking drugs, what they're told about whether or not the drugs will be, quotes, addictive, end quotes, or not, and what they're told about the likely adverse consequences of stopping taking the medication. So it's quite a lot to unpack, I think. I think what we're getting is a degree of support from politicians and policymakers, but also I have to say from members of the medical profession that now is the time to start looking at these issues quite seriously. And then after we've done the review of the evidence, to think about what guidelines need to be laid out for clinicians about how they should approach these issues in the future.
Yeah, well, it's really good. And I mean, you guys are just, you've got a lot going on there that we don't have going on there. The oppression here of people who attempt to do anything good is quite extraordinary. And because what I had to go through was unspeakable in the first few decades. But that I think I've earned those enemies, because I did have had an effect and still am. But we're getting more and more people over here. But not so many in the professions. You know, Bob Whitaker, such an outstanding contributor. He's really international, and he's a journalist. He's an American, but he's a journalist. And but I'm seeing some hope here. And just today, talking on the phone with some folks about what can we do to bring together the Americans who are working in this area to do more. Yeah. And you guys provide models of that.
Well, I think also, I mean, this is in part, I think, yeah, thanks from some of us to some of the pioneers. I mean, I think that people like yourself, Peter, and David Healy, for instance, have come in for an awful lot of stick and for some pretty disgraceful treatment by various professional groups and agents of the pharmaceutical industry and so forth. And indeed, my own PhD supervisor, Richard Bentall, I observed him being quite harshly criticized by people. Social media is not kind, and there's been quite a lot of abusive and nasty material on social media. But I think that people like myself, Joe Moncrief suffers a little bit, but myself and Sami Tamimi and so forth, I think we're robustly criticized, but we have possibly suffered less at the hands of critics and proponents of, you know, very hardline biomedical psychiatry than those of us sort of one or two PhD theses ahead of us in seniority. So I think, yeah, there's less nastiness directed at people like myself. If you ignore Twitter, where things are just repellently nasty, but yes, I think you know, people like Bob yeah. Whitaker, myself, Joe Moncrief, we're often invited to discuss with senior players and politicians. I think there's also an increasing acceptance by policymakers that these are issues that need to be discussed in those forums, rather than a fringe and slightly crazy activity by academics, clinicians who write their own books, but we can safely ignore them. You know, the idea that these are things that are discussed in our parliaments, in our senates, that these are things that are matters for the Norwegians to pass regulations for the delivery of healthcare, for our politicians in the UK to have these sorts of issues about psychiatric drugs, their effectiveness, their modes of action and withdrawal syndromes to be part of the agenda for, you know, political meetings, you know, in the houses of legislation. This is significant stuff. So I think that although you and David Healy and others suffered quite a lot in the past few years, I think it is becoming mainstream matters. There's stuff on the front page of the New York Times, Ben Carey's articles about, you know, the effectiveness and the consequences of stopping taking antidepressants was widely discussed. I think it was on the front page of the New York Times. It was certainly, you know, high up in the readership for the New York Times. So I think, yeah, I think we're becoming a little bit more mainstream. It's a little bit more acceptable. And I think people like myself have got a slightly easier ride, like I say, than you and David Healy did in the past. And that's very encouraging. You know, it's a matter of ordinary debate as to, you know, how effective are these drugs? Is this the way we want to go?
Right.
Should this be what we're doing to our kids? And that's an okay thing to talk about, rather than a crazy fringe issue to be ignored by mainstream politicians. And that's great. That's really good. Twitter's another matter. Twitter's a bit nasty, but that's Twitter, I think.
Well, my wife, God bless Ginger, she handles Twitter.
Yes, yeah.
So I don't get to see that. She actually puts up a lot of protection for me, between me and the social media. That's just a good fortune that I have. I don't get to see that very much.
Yeah. And I think in part, I'm not going to bother looking, but I sent a tweet this morning saying that I was about to go into this meeting in it's a government office building called Portcullis House. And I sent a tweet saying I was going to go to the all party parliamentary group on prescribed drug dependence. It's quite possible that there's been some comment about this on social media, but in part it's kind of impotent fury by people who kind of hope that we're not having these sorts of discussions in the forums that we're having them. But, you know, life moves on, and actually people are discussing these issues front and center. Our national bodies are collecting data on them. We will find out what's going on. We will look at whether there's any evidence for some of the claims made by some of the professional groups, but also by the pharmaceutical industry. We'll look at it. If their claims turn out to be justified, fine, then, you know, that's great. If it turns out that we need to revise the information that's given to patients, then that's what we'll do. And I think in part, some of the nastiness is because people hope that we won't be given access to these corridors of power. But you know what? We're in them, and we're having these discussions straightforwardly.
I think another aspect that's different in Great Britain, at least to some degree, and I want some feedback again from you on that, which is that in this country, I mean, we're still at the stage where you go into a mental hospital and basically everything that's said about you in the record is unpleasant and is calculated to show that you're mentally ill and justify giving you drugs.
Hmm.
Whereas I get a real sense, for example, from Sami Tamimi, especially, he's a child psychiatrist, talking about valuation of children and so on, that there is a real movement to let go of this sort of reflexive diagnosing when somebody's being treated in the National Health Service, in or out of a hospital, and to actually try to describe what's going on with the human being. Am I right about that?
Yes, I think you are. So again, I mean, this is so part of my work has been to talk about medication and biomedical models of mental health problems. I think another part which is very active, and this is the medication issue and the impact of psychiatric medication on the chemistry of the brain, is obviously what you, Peter, have been working on for years. I think a slightly different angle on this is the diagnostic issue. And again, this is a very live debate in the UK at the moment. So there are quite a number of us, from a critical perspective, but critiquing and commenting on the issue of diagnosis. So there's a very active group of people, especially on social media, especially on Facebook, talking about the benefits and the possible negative consequences of diagnosis, and thinking about alternative ways to organise services so that people can get the help that they need. And, you know, the debates are robust, and the debates are interesting, and the debates are positive in lots of ways. There's also quite a lot of discussion about alternatives. So, for instance, something that listeners might have heard of is a document that's come out of the British Psychological Society called the Power Threat Meaning Framework. And this was an attempt, I'm a co-author of it, but it was really led by Mary Boyle and Lucy Johnson and others, including people who've used mental health services themselves. And it's an idea, instead of trying to understand mental health problems in terms of the standard DSM or International Classification of Diseases diagnostic labels, but to think about how power has worked in people's lives, the threats that people have been put to, and the meaning that they make of the experiences in their lives. So the power threat meaning framework. And this has been, I think, very valuable and very positive. It's also triggered quite a lot of comment. I think more widely, it's interesting, we have a politician in the UK who I rate very highly, a guy called Norman Lamb, who used to be a minister for health. And he was talking about the diagnosis of personality disorder, which I find a very pejorative, insulting, unscientific label to put on people. And again, you get a minister, you know, a senior politician saying that, in his opinion, diagnostic labels like that should be abandoned in favor of more common sense descriptions of people's experiences and the problems that they have experienced because of those experiences. So there's a lot of kickback to this, with people being very critical of the idea of criticizing diagnoses itself, but also a lot of debate about that. The idea that we should think possibly more in terms of normal human responses to difficult or even traumatic events, and think about the way that we should help people respond to those challenges rather than trying to work out what's wrong with them and then treat the illness. So that diagnostic approach is also current and live and quite an active debate in the UK at the moment. And also wider across Europe. So I'm the British Psychological Society's representative to a charity called Mental Health Europe, which is a cross-European sort of amalgamation of mental health organisations. And again, there we're discussing diagnosis, its benefits, its flaws, alternatives to diagnosis, and starting to critique the idea that the idea of diagnosing people as having illnesses might not be the only way in which we might understand people's problems and offer them help. I have to say again, the response by some biomedical psychiatrists and even some psychologists has been quite negative. But again, personally, I see that as people fearing change, to be honest, fearing what will happen if we threaten or undermine commonly accepted ways of doing things. Personally, I'm a radical. I'm a critic. I don't think that the current iteration of DSM-5 is either God-given or gold standard. I think everything could be critiqued. I think we can think of better ways of doing it, and I think we can think of better ways of allocating services and better ways of thinking about describing people's problems. But you're absolutely right. On the one hand, there's the issue of medication. On the other hand, there's the issue of diagnosis. And again, we're being quite radical and quite provocative in that challenge as well.
Yeah, folks, I don't give diagnoses in my practice except as is needed for, say, insurance coverage or something like that that the client, the patient needs. And then I always sit with whoever I'm writing about and talk to them about what should we write? What would you like me to say? Years ago, we were going to be setting up, people were talking in this country about a new journal that was going to be really cutting edge. And it was really psychologists mostly. And I won't mention any of the names, but there were great names in psychology and in group therapy and other things. And I propose that if we do a journal like that, that if we have a description of the patient or the client, you know, clinical studies, which they wanted to have, that we show it, that the only way to publish it would be to also show it to the client and allow them to give their own perspective on their life and to compare it with the treatment psychologist's with the psychiatrist's viewpoint. And I mean, their whole attitude toward me changed on the spot.
Yes. And yes.
I was not invited to further participate in the journal, which never came to light.
See, I like that way of thinking. There's a number of things. So one approach is the idea of, it also fits into the idea of people's rights to see and change and hold information about themselves. So part of the idea of the what happens in mental health services here is that, you know, notes are kept on patients. I had 2 years of psychotherapy myself when I was younger, and it was only a year or so ago that I obtained copies of my own psychiatric notes. And it's quite a threatening thing. You know, I'm a senior guy and I've held senior positions and I've hobnobbed with politicians and, you know, spend my time wandering in and out of the Houses of Parliament. But even so, to sit down and open up an envelope that contained within it a thick manila folder full of notes taken on me by a psychiatrist was a pretty daunting prospect. So part of this, again, it's the issue for me, which is of politics. It's about policies and procedures. It's not necessarily the technical work done by the psychiatrist or by the psychologist or by the psychotherapist. It's also about it. So think of what the difference would be if instead of notes being the property of the hospital and the responsibility of the psychiatrist, at the end of the session, the notes were given to me as the patient and I held them. I mean, the shift in power would be remarkable if we did that. And I think the way in which the language would change, the way in which the system responded to people's needs would be remarkably different. So, you know, why are my psychiatric notes the property of the hospital, not the property of the patient? And you could bring in all sorts of stuff about people's responsibilities, but it would dramatically change the power relationships and the things that are described about patients by healthcare providers without their knowledge and the way that this can leak out in some ways, that would dramatically change. The other thing is about, so one of the criticisms of the work of people like myself would be to say, you know, what would happen if we were to do away with psychiatric diagnoses, for instance? So, you know, if somebody were profoundly depressed and they weren't able to use a psychiatric diagnostic label, would they be, you know, no longer entitled to take time off work, no longer entitled to get a pension on ill health grounds? Would they no longer get benefits? How could you possibly? And of course, the answer is we need to devise systems that are better. So instead of refusing people's treatment because they don't have a diagnosis, what we need to do is develop services that will respond to auditory hallucinations, or if somebody cuts themselves, or if people experience anxiety rather than meeting the diagnostic criteria. But we do have to devise systems and services and protocols and ways of delivering services that can work in different ways rather than just accepting the status quo. So I think the point about, you know, sharing our descriptions or our formulations or our diagnosis with our clients. Your suggestion, I 100% agree, but I'd go further in that, even then, why are psychiatric notes owned by the hospital and not owned by the patient? And why is it the case that the current iteration of psychiatric diagnostic classifications are seen as, if we deviate from them at all, then chaos will ensue, apart from the fact that we've now changed DSM five times and will undoubtedly change it a sixth time. The works are already in work. The works are already in progress. So clearly we can change these systems. Let's bite the bullet and change
them. Let me say something about the ownership issue. And by the way, I've been listening so much, I haven't mentioned that this Peter Kinderman has been on our radio show before and is a psychologist, just a great psychologist out of Great Britain, where there are really just a lot more people doing some really good thinking than here in the U.S. And of course, we're so much larger too. And I think that it's hard for us all to get together as easily and think together
as
easily.
I
think size is a problem. But Peter, in this country, actually, people do own their own psychiatric notes. That is, they have the legal right to go to any hospital and say, I want my records. And they have to be given to them. And they can do it with their private physicians and so on. Now, what tends to happen is the only time people do that is when they're upset and thinking about what was done to them, or maybe thinking about a lawsuit. So then they have to pry them out of the psychiatrist, often with a lawyer. But in this country, you do own the record in the sense that you should be able to obtain it at any time. Well, and if you're tough enough about it, you'll get it.
Well, I think that's very similar in the UK. So, I mean, slightly different in the sense that the record in the UK, the regulations, as I understand it, are that your psychiatric records are technically the property of the hospital or the NHS trust, in our case.
Yeah. But you are, I don't think that's true here.
You have a copy of them. But it's not universal. Yeah. It's also the case that, that's clearly different from, for instance, if I want to sell my house, then I will get an architect or a surveyor in to do a structural report on my house. And they'll come in, they'll look around my house, they'll do a structural report on the house, and they'll give me the report. It's my report. It's my house. It's my commission. It's my report. What happens in medical care is you go to see your physician, and they see you, and they write the report, and then you have to request to get a copy of the thing that's happened. And just all I'm saying, I'm not necessarily even recommending that the system be changed. What I'm saying is, let's think creatively about.
I think it should be changed. Peter, we have a very interesting thing here going on, which I hadn't even thought about except for listening to you and talking with you, which is when I go to my internist here, for example, who's part of a hospital in a hospital system. Now we are getting, on the way out, the report that he's written. It's very interesting. It's a simple, usually quite short, and I don't think there's another report that's written. In other words, we get what the doctor says about our evaluation and how we're doing, and it's usually quite brief, and we get it. We carry it home. So this is a new thing maybe that's starting over here.
Yeah, and I think that this idea of democratization of mental health care is vital because – so I actually don't think that the changes that we're talking about in terms of better care, more equitable care, better treatment when people are in residential care, more humane approaches, the more widespread use of social and psychological interventions, the reduced use of medication, all of those things that we, I think, want, I don't think they're going to come about because clinicians, even psychologists, change their practice through academic discourse. I think they'll come when citizens claim their rights to better healthcare. And I think that that relies on a reduction of the negative discriminatory attitudes that people have towards mental health issues, so that you can say, in the same way that if I dislocated my shoulder and gone to a doctor and the doctor had insulted me and refused to treat me properly for a dislocated shoulder, I would have absolutely no shame in calling them out for bad practice. Well, we shouldn't be ashamed of bad practice in mental health care, and we should come out. So when the stigma and the discriminatory attitudes reduce, people will be more willing to complain about poor healthcare. When we change the idea of mental health issues being due to biological faults in the individual, I think we'll be less stigmatizing and critical of people. And when we're more able to claim our rights, I think then all of a sudden the doctors, the psychiatrists, and the clinical psychologists will, when faced with citizens who are demanding their rights, as we all should, then magically overnight we'll start to say, well, you know what, we should look at whether these drugs have nasty side effects. Well, yes, well, there are alternatives. Well, why not? We'll build up our psychotherapeutic responses. Well, of course we can offer you residential care without forcing medication down your throat. But I think that will happen not when our clinicians suddenly realize what the journals have been saying and when the scientists suddenly discover a new fact. I think it will happen when citizens claim their rights.
Yeah, I like everything you're saying. It just gave me an idea of what it would be like if at the end, we've only got about a minute now, Peter, but if at the end of every session, I tend to give a full hour if I can, if we said to the patient, well, let's now, before you go, let's write out your note.
Yes.
What do you
yes,
think absolutely. Happened today? And let me tell you what I think happened. And
yes.
let's write, and we'll write out this note together or something like that. It would be astonishingly yes. different and so respectful.
Yes.
Peter, closing yes. thoughts? I think we've got just a little time left.
I'm really quite optimistic. I think that things are shifting towards a much more humane perspective. And I think it's a snowballing process, because as we get more open and honest and humane, I think it will give people the power to talk more openly about their problems.
Yeah.
When that happens, I think people will be more able to stand up for their rights.
Yeah. Peter, you're a very, very well-known psychologist. Do you get invited to the U.S. to American Psychological Association meetings, Humanistic Psychology Association meetings, to talk about these issues to a large group?
Yes and no. So I do get invited over to the U.S., but as you hinted, the Humanistic Psychology section of the American Psychological Association, Division 32, are more amenable to my perspective than the standard clinical psychology section. I have to say, when myself and colleagues like Lucy Johnson and so forth talk to American psychologists, our audiences tend to be slightly smaller than the mainstream, diagnose people with major depressive disorder and treat them with the latest variant of CBT. So I think American psychologists still quite like their diagnosis and treat model.
Oh, yes. I think Humanistic Psychology Group here in the U.S. does not want to support my critical yeah. approach to drugs at all, yeah. as far as I can tell. Not at all. They want to grow up and work with the psychiatrists. Peter Kinderman from Great Britain, thank you for being on the radio show, the Dr. Peter Bregenhauer. Folks, next week, big news. I'm going to take questions starting at the half hour. First time. Going to take questions, please, about the people on the show, not so much about treatment, please. Next week, I'm going to do it, though. Big news. Questions. Call in.